Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Dr. David Coleman, clinical child psychologist, is here. Hi, David. You're very welcome.
Good morning, Claire.
Good to see you. Now, we've lots of ground to cover, but I just want to start by talking about the tragic news over the weekend with three siblings murdered in Tallaght and also Jack de Bromhead, who died in that tragic accident in Kerry. And news like this is really hard to comprehend. Everyone's thinking about those children going in to school. They will be looked after. There'll be a support system for them there. But for everybody's child who hears this on the news and for parents who are having to deal with it, what advice do you have?
Oh, goodness. I mean, sometimes it's so difficult to know quite where to start. I think the first thing for lots of parents will be to try to establish, what does your child already know? What do they understand? What sense have they already made of whatever it is that they've heard? Because that then allows you to know, well, what gaps do I need to fill? How might I need to help them process whatever it is that they're experiencing or feeling based on what they've heard? And I guess, you know, because each child's reaction to something like this is going to be different. But I think when something is as, I don't know, poignant or touching, I mean, I think there's definitely a real sense that, you know, the nation has an awareness of this in the way that it possibly doesn't about other things. And I think, you know, there's something perhaps about a need for us to just have a bit of a public outpouring of grief, because I think, you know, we've had 2.5 years of loss and grieving with COVID in so many different ways. And lots of what we've done in the past as a nation, I mean, we've always been very good with death, and our rituals around death have always, I think, been really supportive for people. There's a lot of community solidarity around grieving and death in Ireland. But when it came to COVID, all that was, you know, it was just, yeah, I don't know, restricted. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps that's why this is so significant now, for not just the particular communities involved, the two different communities here, but at a wider level. So I think but when it comes to kids, I mean, kids process stuff, you know, when adults are there to support them emotionally, and the emotional support is ultimately about checking in, not necessarily trying to reassure them that this can't happen to them, but just letting them know that, you know, their feelings make sense in the context of what they understand.
I just wonder, though, you know, in the case of Christy and Chelsea and Lisa in Tallaght, how far do you go in explaining that? I mean, clearly you have to look at the age of your child, but I think one of the really important things you said there, David, was you have to establish what they know already.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, again, you know, let's hope that most children don't know the full details. I mean, most of us probably don't know the full details either, but it sounds like it's been very violent. And I guess that element of it is also adds to the shock and the fear, perhaps, for some children. And that's what it is that you're exploring. Like I say, you know, once you know what they understand already, you know if there are gaps that then need to be filled in terms of how you might support them. Because, you know, not every child will have an awareness. For some, it will have gone over the top of their head, and that's fine, you know, and that's okay. And so then you just process your own stuff. And but I think it's about just, yeah, checking in with them, particularly if you hear, you know, comments or if they seem off form, you know, and there's no other good explanation for why your child feels off or seems off form, then it might well be that they're, you know, trying to get their head around what's happened, mm-hmm. and trying to understand it. But ultimately, it's talking with them, yep. and just empathizing a lot and letting them know, yeah, the feelings, they're really, yeah, these are sad things that have happened. They're tragic things, and you know, that makes sense.
Keep the lines of communication open, which is always good advice. Now, the other thing we wanted to talk to you about, which is happening at the moment, the Leaving Cert results, and lots of people did very well, and that's great, but not everyone is pleased with their results, and that mightn't mean that they got a bad Leaving Cert or that they won't ultimately get what they want in the third round, but just didn't get what they expected, and that can be really difficult for people to deal with.
Yeah, I think it's potentially, yeah, a source of real disappointment for a cohort of young people. Not, as you say, all. I mean, there'll be some who'll be delighted and some will have overachieved and they'll have surpassed their expectations and perhaps other people's expectations. And I guess, again, you know, with all the kind of points inflation that's occurred over the last couple of years with the CAO and because the Leaving Cert itself has changed and the scoring systems and so on have changed, I think that has left a lot of young people as well with a real uncertainty about what might happen come Thursday when the first round of CAO offers come out. And so there will be a group of young people who are dealing with the disappointment. And what we know about the disappointment is that you know, when a young person has a what we'd call a fixed mindset as opposed to a growth mindset, then they're going to find the disappointment all that keener. It's going to be much more difficult for them to process it because they will feel like this is a closed door and nothing can change. And so that's a difficult situation to be in. So the more we can help young people see, I suppose, that growth perspective where, look, you know, this is perhaps a setback. This is a big challenge now and things aren't going to follow the particular path that you thought that they might. But that's still an opportunity for learning. That's still an opportunity for growth. It's still an opportunity for progression. You just might have to take a more circular route to it or a longer route to where you wanted to be. Or maybe actually this is a reason to be thinking, well, was that actually where you really wanted to be? And so maybe there's something really creative that you can do instead. And, you know, at the same time, then you're also trying to be that rock where you're saying, yeah, it's tough going and you seem really upset and really disappointed. And I think you had your heart set on this and that might not happen now. But let's take it one day at a time. And so don't foreshorten things, you know, I mean, wait till Thursday, see what actually happens, see what happens if you get anything in the first round of offers, you know, and if you do, you know, are you going to wait? Maybe you'll get something in the second round that's closer to what it is that you really had your heart set on. But in the short term for families, it's about just, yeah, hanging in there, you know, acknowledging the disappointment, but seeing if you can encourage them to think in this kind of growth mindset way. It was just, I was doing a bit of reading about it over the weekend, and one of the things that they the research that's been done has shown that when we, this is not obviously a particular benefit for the Leaving Cert cohort, but for younger children, when we praise children for their performance, if we praise them for being smart, for, you know, oh, you're so clever at this, you know, that will encourage them into more of a fixed mindset where they're going to think that cleverness is a thing that they should either have or not have. Whereas if we praise them by praising their effort and their the work that they've put into something, then they're much more likely to develop a growth mindset.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that because, okay, if you've done your Leaving Cert and you're really disappointed, that's one thing. But if you're a parent of a child who's coming through the education system, how do you create that growth mindset?
There you are. That's where it starts.
That's where it starts. So we have to be really careful that we're not saying to them the Leaving Cert is the be-all and end-all, 500 points or 400 points or whatever you decide, wherever you decide the line is, that's the be-all and end-all. We have to watch that as parents.
Oh, look, just the last 2 weeks, I suppose, last week in the Irish Independent, I was writing about the, you know, coming into primary schools and how we should really be setting up preschools more and more, you know, along an entirely play-based system as opposed to having any academic input at all, you know, any formal academic input. I mean, I think children will learn, you know, they learn about, you know, kind of pre-literacy and numeracy anyway through play, but actually teaching them their letters and teaching them their numbers, like, it's madness that we still have this focus, you know, and there will be, there's still a group of parents who are still really keen that that happens as early as possible so their child is kind of ready for school when, in theory, of course, this is where they're, what they're going to be learning in school. But anyway, but what we then have is this highly competitive educational system that is really difficult for a lot of young people. And so they do come into school and they do learn quite early on in school, or at least they can experience in school a sense that they're just not smart, that they just don't have what other kids have. And so for a lot of young people, they get entirely turned off at a very young age, and it's very hard to regain that back, a kind of a love of learning or a sense that there's stuff to be explored or a sense that their brain is incredibly plastic and changeable and that it can develop and it will develop in its own way, in its own time. And there are lots of things that may be difficult now, but that won't always be difficult for them to do. And so, you know, that's missing for a lot of young people and children. And that, again, is what we want to try to encourage them. Another piece of research that was done, they actually taught, so seventh graders in America, which is, I think, 11, 12, that kind of age, they told them, they showed them about the brain and how the brain develops and how plastic it is and how malleable it is and how there was nothing fixed, nothing set in stone about their intelligence. And what they discovered is that within a year, the maths grades as a whole for that cohort of kids had risen. Because kids believed that they could achieve more because it was, things weren't fixed and set in stone. So that's a way, I suppose, that we can promote that in at a younger age for children coming through.
And you know, we know, because we're at the age that we're at, that there are many routes into all sorts of careers. Yeah. You know, the CAO and the Leaving Cert is not, we hear it all the time, it's not the be-all and end-all.
It's not the be-all, but it's very hard. I mean, I can remember, I didn't get my first choice. I had a good Leaving Cert, but not the great Leaving me the cert that I wanted and didn't get my first choice. And, you know, I look back now, if I'd gotten my first choice, I'd never have met my wife. You know, my life would have been entirely different, you know, but the choices that were kind of, that I was left with ultimately have proved to be, you know, transformational and positive.
Do you remember being devastated?
Oh, I was so disappointed. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Really, really disappointed. I was one of those young people. That was the day when, I don't know if people remember, like it came in the newspaper. And so there was this incredibly tiny print of all the hundreds of thousands of offers that were coming out, and yet to find your number. And oh my God, it was tragic. I was really, really upset. It took me a long time to accept that what was my second choice that I got offered would actually be good enough, and that it would still allow me to get where I wanted to be, which ultimately it did, and possibly even more successfully, or if that's the right metric to use, but more happily, certainly.
Yeah, you just wish that people who are 18 and 19 and their parents realized all of that.
Of course, but you know, it's difficult because, as you say, how society has set up the Leaving Cert, that it's a be-all, end-all exam, that this is it, this is crunch time, you know, it's you know, success or failure, that there's no middle ground, that there's just performance. And, you know, performance can be compromised by so many different things at the time. And so we have to acknowledge that the reason you might have done badly is not necessarily specific and personal to you. This is not some personal shortcoming. It's actually just something systemic, perhaps. And that then also frees us up to think, okay, well, look, you know, it's not just me. You know, I didn't just fail. I'm not a failure by dint of not getting my first choice now come Thursday. I just didn't, you know, I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve, but I can still get to where I want to be. And you're right. You know, the hindsight that we all have as fully adult adults, as opposed to just brandly newly hatched adults, allows us to see that.
It's unfair to expect a 16 or 17 year old to know what they want to do, you know, to be able to fill out that form with any sort of certainty. It's really, really tough on people of
and
that
there's,
age.
There's very few, I mean, apart from a few different college courses or university courses, most are not vocational. You know, most are not setting you up for a career in any event. They're setting you up to learn a particular set of skills that hopefully then can be transferable and used in so many different settings. And I think perhaps young people have that sense that there is no need to worry about having a career, that they don't need to become a something that will define them for the rest of their lives. But what they do want to have, as I say, is this set of skills that becomes ultimately transferable, that they can, you know, use in so many different settings. And that then allows them to progress to lots of different things over the course of their careers.
Okay, well, let's come to some of our questions now, all of them that have come in to us. We're going to start with one about a young boy who has difficulty controlling his emotions. So this listener says, we often see it happen when he's in the playground. So obviously a young child. The big issue with him is that if another boy or girl wants to play something else or go away, he loses the plot by getting upset, shouting and crying. We try to explain that the other children want to play something else and this is okay, but he can't get his head around this. The same thing happens when something doesn't go his way. He begins to whinge and cry over the slightest thing. These sessions can last up to 10 minutes, but he really seems to have trouble controlling his emotions. Now, David, I don't have an age for that child, but it seems to be somebody who's probably around the toddler, maybe up to 4 or 5.
I'm kind of slightly bemused at the idea of like a 10-minute kind of upset. That's in many people's
books. Getting away lightly there.
That's not a real problem. You know, that's, you know, because, you know, say he's 4 or 5, typically, you know, and so he's just maybe moved through the toddler years. He's, you know, and maybe starting school and still finds, though, that he actually struggles to share, or he struggles to take his turn, or... you know, that's just not unusual. And again, it's about, as a parent, not freaking out about that, but again, offering the empathy, offering the acknowledgement. Oh, you seem really disappointed that they didn't want to play that. Oh, I think you'd have loved it if they'd done this. And oh, and you had to wait and you never got to climb. Oh my goodness. And you really wanted to go down that slide, as opposed to going, come on now, stop. Don't be, just everybody take their turn. You know, so we tend to take a very rational approach as parents sometimes to what are to a 4 or 5 year old, you know, life and death moments, even though they're not.
Yeah.
And that's just it. They just have a different perspective. They're so living in the moment that these disappointments are so keen and they're unfiltered. So as we get older, we learn to filter our experiences through our current experiences, through all of our past experiences. And so, you know, like I was saying, even that, you know, well, a 10-minute tantrum from a child, you know, relative to somebody who's tantruming for an hour is a minor tantrum. But that's because I can compare it to something else. The 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old in the moment moment might have nothing to compare it to. So this devastation that they feel that things have not gone their way, or that they've been shortchanged in some way by somebody else or hard done by somebody else, you know, it's just, it's so unfiltered and raw for them. And so it's about just being really patient, understanding, and also using distraction. If they are of that age, you know, move them on quickly to something else. They, you know, you don't have to linger on it at that age, mm-hmm. because you can take advantage of the fact that their attention can can chop and change quite quickly. And so just distract them onto something more positive. But like I say, 10 minutes is not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get it down to 5, a little bit of empathy and then a little bit of distraction.
Okay. Now, the next question is about an 11-year-old boy who has visible tics from time to time. His current tic is a combination of shrugging shoulders, blinking and unusual head movements. He has a tendency to be anxious too, but he says nothing in particular is bothering him. Do I ignore the tic, says this parent, or do I say something to him?
So again, it depends on whether the tics are causing him a problem. So if they're very noticeable in other social settings and he's getting comments back from other people about his movements, his body movements, then absolutely as a parent, it's worth sitting down with him, exploring it a little bit and trying to see, you know, what kind of help would he like? Because when it comes to tics, most tics are anxiety based. They're a kind of a physical manifestation of anxiety. And so the first stage is usually trying to help the child acknowledge or notice the tics, because they might be so automatic that the child doesn't even notice that they're doing it. And so that's just about bringing their awareness to it in a gentle way. And then usually the other most successful way that you can help kind of move things on is by finding some other something that they can do. They call it HRT, habit reversal.
Having something in your hand, maybe?
Yeah, or that. So say, for example, if it's a tic where their eye is twitching, yeah. God, I, of course, automatically do a little twitch in my own eye when I'm describing that. But so it might be about getting them to do a hard blink with both eyes.
So a very conscious decision to blink.
Yeah, so that they just regain, if you like, a kind of a sense of control of that kind of movement. Or it may be that they put their hands over their eyes, again, just to, you know, kind of not block things out. It doesn't change the experience, but it's almost like just that they do another something that doesn't cause them the same kind of problem.
So you're just breaking the behavior.
You're trying to introduce. And so introducing a different behavior that's less problematic is often a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. Skin picking would be another one, similar to tics, where, you know, habit bring in a new habit that's less dangerous or harmful is a good thing. Okay. But bringing the awareness is the first stage.
Okay, anyway. I think we have time for one more. This is about a teenage boy smoking weed. Most of his group of friends smoke weed. We tell him that we don't want him to do it. We tell him about the dangers of the drug. He's admitted to me that he would find it very difficult to stop, but also that he does not intend to stop. We feel powerless. What approach should we take? Now, I'm sure that's from a worried parent.
Yeah, but great that they're already having the conversation. So, it would be a lot more difficult if their son, it sounded like it was a son.
It's a boy, yeah.
Yeah, was absolutely refusing to engage with them about it and shutting them off or blocking them down. I mean, yeah, at least he's talking about it.
See, what I see in that question to you is he admits that he would find it very difficult to stop. Now, I'm terrified if that's me. If my son has said that to me, that's the big concern. Even though, as you say, the positive is talking, that's a worry.
So I think he would find it very possible to stop. It's whether he wants to stop.
Okay.
And that sounds like it's probably driven by the peer group that he's with, and that the particular group of friends, that's what will make it difficult for him to change his behavior, because it might not allow him to be part of that group if he's the one who's no longer, you know, smoking along with everybody else. And so these are the questions to be sitting down and talking with him about, does he have any desire or motivation from a personal intrinsic level, or is it all about just the particular grouping? Because, you know, he could change his group of peers if he really, really wanted to, if it was significant enough for him. But for the time being, he doesn't, you know, he's not suffering. He doesn't see any danger in what he's doing. And so he's not motivated yet to change it. And I guess that might be also about giving him information about the dangers. And so it might be about saying to him, look, we'd really like you to meet with, a drug and alcohol counselor, not because we think you've got, you know, an addiction problem, but because we want you to understand things about the way these these drugs are affecting you that we can't properly describe to you. And sometimes for young people, you know, hearing some of the real facts about the dangers of drugs, not just, you know, at a personal health level, but at a societal level, you know, so if they hear it from, you know, from Gardaí sometimes in some of the liaison settings, it can actually be significant that they think, oh, actually, yeah, okay, this is not just about me smoking a bit of weed. This has lots of other connotations that really I don't want to be involved
in. Okay, but the good news is the lines of communication are open. David, thanks very much for coming in. And David will be back with us in a couple of weeks. So if you have any questions, do get them into us now. Email today, cb@rte.ie.